The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Welcome to Report from Asia. Our guest is Harry Tan. He is head of research for the Asia-Pacific region for TH Real Estate. And he is also the author of a recent market perspective column in Institutional Real Estate Asia-Pacific magazine. The column headlines City DNA, in which he makes the argument that a city-based approach to real estate investing actually helps investors capitalize on Asia-Pacific's growth in a perhaps a better way than the non-city-based approach. He joins us by phone from London. I believe it's London. Where are you, Harry? In London or Singapore?
In Singapore.
Singapore. Harry, let me officially welcome you to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Mike. Glad to be here.
Let's talk about this city-based approach you advocate. As I said, you wrote a column on it, and it's a city-based approach to real estate investing. Talk about the city-based approach. What are the components of this city-based approach?
Well, quite simply, we believe that it's the smart selection of cities, not countries, to invest into real estate or real assets more broadly. That will help deliver attractive long-term risk-adjusted returns for investors. Over the next 10 years, it is the top 600 cities that will contribute almost two-thirds of global GDP growth, out of which about 200 will be Chinese cities. Now, perhaps to take you a step further, if we take China, for instance, Beijing from an economic, business, consumer, geographic, and cultural point of view, even while it differs significantly from Chongqing to the west, they share many of the same legal and policy system within the same country. Now, we make a clear distinction between Beijing and Chongqing. We think that's important, particularly for real estate, as it's such a local business. I guess what's even more interesting is that some cities, such as Tokyo and Beijing, may look and they may feel dissimilar in terms of physical outlook or in terms of the business landscape. But, they actually share quite similar growth drivers. Now, both cities, for instance, are highly dense. They're underpinned by strong business concentration. Now, among the Fortune 500 companies, for instance, 51 are headquartered in Beijing and 39 in Tokyo, while there are only about 20 in New York and I believe about 18 in London. Now, just given that we're talking about Tokyo, and just to reinforce this point about being a city and not country focused, even while Japan is aging, as we know, and has a declining population, Tokyo's population continues to grow at about 1% over the past decade, which means that Tokyo's trend growth is actually much higher than Japan as a whole. So while we like Tokyo and Osaka in Japan, we do not necessarily believe in investing in Kyoto or Sapporo, for instance.
You know, I noticed that in your story, I'm taking a look at what you wrote in the column, and you were making the point that by 2030, 11 of the biggest 25 cities in the world by output will reside in the region, yep. And the Asia-Pacific cities will account for 46 of the top 50 cities with the largest changes in household wealth between 2010 and 2030. So obviously, these are almost like city states. They're real powerhouses. That much is very clear. So in a sense, I want to ask you what makes a city-based approach effective, but obviously you're talking about these centers of economic activity that are enormous. So that in itself almost answers the question, but I still want to lay that in your lap, Harry, because there may be more to say about that. What does make the city-based approach effective?
Well, TH Real Estate's our investment philosophy has always been guided, first and foremost, by our global cities strategy. We have identified out of around 4,000 cities, the top 2% that we believe are best positioned to benefit from global secular megatrends that can future-proof against short-term cyclical volatilities. And there are about 90 cities that we've chosen globally, out of which 17 of them are in Asia Pacific. Now, this approach is effective, we believe, as we very clearly define the parameters and the filters which we believe are important in selecting the most resilient cities in tomorrow's world. Now, for instance, in our model, in our framework, in our first cut, we have identified about 4,000 cities with a population of at least 150,000. Now, scale in this case is important, as bigger cities are more productive, they're more competitive, they draw in more investments and the best talents, and these are the cities that stay relevant over time. And then we underlay our selection with transparency filters. In other words, we choose cities that provide the liquidity, the data availability, and the transactions in real estate. Because at the end of the day, I think the key thing is we are looking to put capital to work in markets that are investable. Now, the next layer of filter we have used is a stability filter, which only includes cities in countries with adequate political and economic stability. Now, allowing for these three filters, scale, transparency, and stability, that would have allowed us to narrow down the number of cities we want to be looking at to about 200. Now, this is just part of the matrix in our framework. I guess the most important in my mind is our mega trend filter, which we have used to select the top 90 global cities, looking at the hard growth, soft and sustainability factors. Now, examples of hard factors would be things like population size, the number of middle-class households, for instance. For soft factors, we look at connectivity, and we look at the quality of life. And then, environmental risk would be considered under our sustainability factors. And then we assign weights to these factors, as we don't believe in investing only in the biggest or fastest growing cities, but rather, cities with the right mix of ingredients that will continue to position them for future relevance and in turn support the local real estate market. So for us, having a global approach and framework is the most effective way to articulate our strategy and our investment outlook to our clients. We are clear about where, we are clear about what we want to invest into over the long term that best positions a portfolio for durable income and total returns. Now, especially at this part of the cycle, it's critically important not to style drift into the yield premium.
You know, I was going to say that when you started off talking about 4,000 cities and the smallest of them 150,000, I'm thinking, wow, that's an awfully small city for an investor to be putting money into. But then you had mentioned that, okay, you filtered them down to 90 cities. So what is the size of the smallest of those 90 cities?
Well, most of the smaller cities, to be honest, would be in Europe. So out of the 90 cities, we have about 45 in Europe. We have got about 20 plus in the US, and we have got 17 cities in Asia Pac. The reason why there are so many small cities in Europe, obviously, is that many of the European cities are of a quite similar size, except for the big ones like London and Frankfurt, for instance. Now, in Asia Pac, as you can imagine, a lot of the focus of economic activity, business activity, is in some of the key gateway or capital cities. Just as an example, Tokyo in Japan and Seoul in South Korea accounts for slightly less than a third of the national GDP. So the reason why we have smaller cities in Asia Pac is simply because a lot of these cities are much bigger than those in Europe. And, you know, many Chinese cities are fast-growing. They will continue to grow at a much rapid rate, given that they're developing quickly. And we're going to see a lot more Chinese cities getting bigger over time. So I wouldn't be surprised if we're going to include more Chinese cities into our selection over the coming years.
Okay, and I suppose I'm sure that one of those 90 cities is San Francisco, and San Francisco has fewer than a million people, so a fairly small city, especially compared to the size of many Asian cities, but nonetheless a very potent real estate market. So, but let's talk about the DNA. Give us an example of how decoding a city's DNA informs what type. Before we even get to that, your argument is that every city has a DNA, and so basically a genome. So what are the components of a city's DNA? Now, you're talking about filters. I'm assuming that the filters are something different, but what are the components that make up a city's DNA?
Well, quite simply, every city has its own DNA. Or rather, a mix of personality traits that drives it, or the economy, and ultimately the real estate market. So for real estate investors, understanding a city's DNA allows us, after we have selected the cities we want to invest into, to look deeper into the relevant sectors within the city that are best positioned for growth and returns. Now, a city's DNA can have numerous traits or numerous personality traits. Tokyo, for instance, it's a political powerhouse. It's a mega metropolis, and it's also a culture capital. Now, over time, it may also develop another trait, such as a tourist trap, for instance. And what's interesting is, you know, many developed gateway cities, such as Beijing and Seoul, would also share some of these traits, such as culture capital, such as a mega metropolis. Now, if we take Hong Kong as another example, its DNA will also include density dividend. As you can imagine, it's highly populated. It's also a millennial magnet. And it's also a tourist trap.
Give us an example of how decoding a city's DNA informs the types of real estate investments that we would make. For example, Hangzhou, China, or Suzhou, China. Would decoding either one of those cities' DNA tell me whether or not I'm going to be better off investing in housing versus office versus the hotel market and so on?
Yeah, right. So this is a really good question. unfortunately, Suzhou is not one of the 17 cities that were selected.
Oh, okay.
But you know, if I were to take Hong Kong as an example of one of the 17 cities, it is, you know, it is a tourist trap for mainland Chinese, for instance, which means that you know, tenant demand through high footfall at high street shops or private shopping centers points to an attractive proposition for retail in this particular market. Now, taking Tokyo as another example, maybe, it's a mega metropolis, and that suggests to us that multifamily will be attractive, on top of the fact that about 40% of the housing market in Tokyo is for lease. If we were to use Seoul as an example, it's a technology trailblazer in our mind. That means that we we favor the Gangnam office market more so than the Yoido office market, as the Gangnam office market attracts a lot more of the high-tech startups, which are going to demand space, office space, within the Gangnam office area. So some of the examples that perhaps shows why we look more deeply into the DNA of the city, essentially what drives the city's economic, cultural, or social fabric.
How different are the DNAs of various cities? Let's take, perhaps comparing an Asian city to a European city or to a North American city. Are there are the distinctions very stark in a lot of cases? And maybe you can even name a couple of cities, Harry, that are very different in terms of DNA.
Well, I'm not certain about the U.S. and European cities, but if I were to just look at some of the Asian cities, for instance, and going back to what I've said, they kind of share quite similar personality traits in some, while in others, one or two particular traits would stand out more that actually drives the economic or social landscape. Now, back to my point about gateway cities. Many gateway cities within Asia-Pacific, they are capital cities by default, although not necessarily the political powerhouse. So just perhaps to give an example, you know, Australia's capital is in Canberra. Even though the business hub is in Sydney, or as some Australians would argue, in Melbourne. So in that regard, Singapore, for instance, would be a big business center. It's also obviously an island state and therefore the capital. And it has strong, density dividend. So there are many personality traits that cut across many of the key Asia-Pacific cities that were selected. One or two may actually stand out more than others, which actually drives the sort of strategies that we have for the particular market.
Asia is obviously your part of the world, Asia-Pacific or Asia-Pac for short. Now, I assume there's nothing Asia-specific about this philosophy of investing, Harry, that it could be applied to cities and continents around the world. But is there anything particular about Asian cities that make the city-based approach especially appropriate?
Well, you're right that this framework of city selection, I think it's holistic. It can be consistently applied globally. Perhaps what is more interesting is that Asia Pacific is the epicenter of many of the mega trends that we are seeing today. So by 2030, this part of the world it will account for more than half of global output. It's going to account for a third of global consumption, And, you know, about 60% of the increase in the global urbanization rate will come from Asia. So as a consequence, you know, compared to Europe or the US, where most likely, you know, the hierarchy of the chosen cities will not change that much over time, as growth in these cities do not vary a lot. Our selected cities for Asia-Pac are more likely to expand. As you can imagine, you know, many Chinese cities are growing at a much faster clip than European or US cities. And they will become bigger, they will become more productive, and they will become more investable. So I would not be surprised if, again, you know, more Chinese cities are added to the list of investable cities within Asia-Pacific in the coming years. You know, after all, the progressive cities today, the fast-growing ones, they will become the principal cities for tomorrow's world, because they're going to mature, they're going to develop, and, you know, they're going to be more investable. So just you know, as a point of interest, you know, by 2030, 11 of the, you know, 25 biggest cities globally by output will come from this part of the world. So it's really exciting to be working within Asia-Pacific.
Now, you mentioned megatrends a couple of different times. What are some of the megatrends that are embodied by Asia's leading cities? Can you just tick off what those megatrends are?
Well, urbanization is definitely one of them, particularly in China. From just 20% about three decades ago, we are looking at an urbanization rate closer to 55% today. And we expect that to increase to about 70% by 2030. Now, what this means is that we're going to have about 300 million people over this period moving into cities, which is, you know, which is equivalent to the entire population of the U.S., really. And that, in turn, is going to create, obviously, demand for housing. Now, I think the other key mega trend really is about the rise of the middle class within Asia-Pacific. That's also going to continue driving our outlook for our investments into some of the Asian cities. Now, for better or worse, if whether you like it or not, China again comes to the fore. China currently has about 110 million middle-class households, which is more than the U.S., which I believe is about 90 to 95 million. And we expect another 130 million households to be added to this segment in China over the coming decade. Now, this this is actually quite astonishing. And, you know, to us, to the company, it directly implies a more favorable outlook for housing, for retail sales, and obviously not to mention the impact on tourism globally. As you may be aware, Chinese consumers already account for about 30% of global luxury purchases today. So I'll be surprised if this trend does not continue.
I'm glad you mentioned tourism, because The Economist magazine just did a big piece about the influence of China through its people who are traveling freely around the world, and in many cases relocating, just deciding, you know, I think I want to live in Sydney, or I think I want to live in London, or where, or in Africa, going to continents like Africa and starting to work on infrastructure project, agricultural projects, and so on. And so China's influence is also spreading in that way. Thinking in terms of that also being a megatrend, maybe not an investable megatrend necessarily, probably outside the scope of what you're talking about right here with real estate investing, but I'd still like you to speak to that. What about China in this outsized influence it's quickly gaining by having its people traveling all over the world, whether to visit or relocate either temporarily or permanently?
Well, this is a really interesting question, Mike. We have often a proxy for Chinese consumerism, as you can imagine. So for investor who's looking to invest into the Chinese growth story, but not necessarily perhaps in some cities in China, they can use Chinese tourism overseas as a proxy for Chinese demand. I think that's a key message that we've been conveying to clients. So if you want to proxy Chinese consumerism, you could possibly be looking at consumer spending in London, in New York, in Paris, because these are cities that Chinese tourists increasingly have been visiting. And the other thing about Chinese tourism or Chinese going overseas really is that, they bring experiences back to China. They bring the education, if they go overseas for education, they bring the educational background back to China, and they bring a different perspective to consumerism or to work when they return to China. So the influence is not just confined to China, it's something that we're seeing globally. And this is going to continue in our mind.
One more question, Harry, and that is the invisible elephant in the room, and that is India. India is a huge nation. It's going to exceed China in population soon, is my understanding. And yet its influence, its economic power and its influence really pales compared to China, yet it's full of potential. So as you look down the road, there's Mumbai and maybe some other cities that are part of your 90 global cities, but India seems to be a real underperformer at this point, but people can clearly see the potential there. They produce a lot of highly technical people. They're responsible as much as any part of the world for developing Silicon Valley here in the United States. What about India?
Well, India at the moment is not one of the Indian cities are not part of the basket of cities that we've selected for Asia Pac. We are looking at India more closely, clearly given how fast it's growing. But we are slightly concerned about some of the issues that India faces, for instance, education. The level of general education in that country, the transparency of some of the markets in some of the cities in India, and issues about infrastructure, issues about policy, for instance. This is not to say that we are ruling out Indian cities. We are definitely keeping an eye on India. But at the moment, it's not part of our city's selection yet. China has been growing at a much faster clip and developing more quickly than India, simply because there is a roadmap in China, the five-year plan that actually lays out what needs to be done over the next 5 years from an economic perspective. And to that point, it gives us more reassurances about the outlook for China from a real estate investment perspective.
Our guest has been Harry Tan. He is head of research for the Asia Pacific region for TH Real Estate. And we have been talking about a piece he wrote. I want to direct our readers to this particular piece. It is in the May edition of the Institutional Real Estate Asia Pacific. And we've been talking about this particular column, really a look at city DNA and a city-based approach to real estate investing. An interesting concept, one that I assume, Harry, this is still something that's in development. It's well developed enough that you're using this model, but I guess I do have one more question for you, and that is that what are you looking at in ways of refinement? If I was having this conversation with you in 2 or 5 years, would the model be the same, or are you expecting some refinements to be put into place with this investing philosophy?
Well, the framework would largely stay the same. We may add more filters into the framework in order to refine perhaps the list of cities that were selected. But largely, it's pretty much where we are. And I guess, beyond just looking at a selection of cities, beyond just looking at the DNA, what we are also doing is to drill into the local market more deeply. In other words, if we were to be looking into the office market in Hong Kong, we'll be looking into the different sub-districts and deciding where the fundamentals are more attractive and making investments into the local sub-district as opposed to just the city as a whole. So, yeah, we are continuing to do work on cities from our end.
And, actually, one more question, and that is that how long have you been using this model for investing, and does it have a long enough track record that you could actually make the claim that it offers a superior return on real estate investing?
Well, we have been using this framework for about 4 years now, 4 to 5 years, I believe. And we pretty much started using this framework for our European Cities Fund, which at this point has raised quite a significant amount of money because investors clearly love the story. They like the fact that we are specific about the cities or the markets that we want to invest into, rather than leaving it open-ended.
Interesting. Well, an interesting model, and we certainly want to check back with you and TH Real Estate down the road and see how everything is panning out with this. Harry Tan, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.